society right now is timidly walking into embracing these technologies, the costs of them. They were called pilots, tests, experiments, beta versions. And that's really the wrong attitude. The world needs to run, I think, aggressively into transformation instead of tiptoeing up to it. I think that we need to be more synthetic in our thinking, both in terms of the technology and the materials that we engage, but also, you know, our formative influence on architecture, on urban design.
Redesigning cities. Speedwell Foundation talks.
Welcome to Redesigning Cities, the Speedwell Foundation talks at Georgia Tech. I'm your host, Ellen Dunham Jones, a professor of architecture and urban design at the Georgia Institute of Technology in Atlanta. Joining me is Marcel Wilson, founder of Bionic, a landscape architecture firm in San Francisco. Welcome, Marcel.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Today's episode delves into the ecological imagination and redesigning cities, ecology, technology, synthesis, interface, all of those things. So start us off by telling us a little bit about the ecological challenges that you're excited about engaging in your work.
Bionic is a firm I started about a decade ago, and the idea was just about the world in front of us. It was a time of a recession. There was obviously a lot broken about the world, and in thinking about starting a landscape architecture firm, a design practice, I really wanted for it to be relevant, for it to be addressing the real complexities of the world, not just decorating things, and not just merely servicing clients, but bringing real imagination and invention to the work that we do. And so that required kind of an ambition and even a hypothesis about what a design practice could be.
Well, I noticed that in your slides, in your lecture, you show images of cyborgs and sort of, you know, whether it's the humans with prosthetic mechanical devices, whether it's our digital means of mapping the world, new ways of knowing natural systems. Are you saying that you can't really separate the technology from the nature, the digital from lived experience? Or are you saying that you see a need and a desire to enhance natural systems with what technology can bring us? Or
All of those. I'm a child of the 70s, and the term bionic is, you know, the etymology of it comes from science fiction, the 60s. What I think is really interesting about that is that sort of projected future is coming true. It was hypothesized by something that would be done by, you know, engineers. And I think the term is useful to, you know, take it out of the hands of the engineer and into the hands of the designer, and to think about it in a more expansive way of enabling life, not just human life, but, you know, all life forms. And I guess it gets to the question, to maybe another question of, like, why would you call a landscape architecture firm Bionic? What's behind the name? And there's a couple of reasons. Number one, it's just not about an individual, but about a view of the world, and it has a kind of ambition to it. Two, it has an immediate connotation of the view of the world in front of us, a belief in invention. And three, I think it really captures what we essentially do, which is combine things that are alive and things that are made. And that's not an idea specific to scale. It's really scalable from, you know, the smallest unit that you could conceive of landscapes to the largest. And so when I started this firm, I had no idea if that would work. It was more of a hypothesis about an approach to practice and an ambition for invention.
I love the phrase, just, you know, reducing it down to just sort of combining that which is living with that which is made. We're sitting right now in the Candida building on the Georgia Tech campus. It replaced an inefficient, obsolete building with what are now known as living buildings. It's the first of its kind in the hot and humid Southeast. It generates more power and water than it uses. outside behind us. The former parking lot has been depaved and is now being replanted as an extension of the what we on the tech campus call the Eco Commons, with native shrubs and grasses to restore the natural stormwater systems and replace the pipes. Inside, the materials are healthy, local, salvaged, and part of a socially equitable economy. In fact, there were 30-some formerly homeless people who were trained and hired as woodworkers. So is this an example of something that's both part living, part made?
Sure. I think this exhibits like the solution and the problem. This is a brand new building. We're here in 2020. All the technology that went into doing this has been around for decades, right? It illustrates the scale issue that society right now is timidly walking into embracing these technologies, the costs of them. They were called pilots, tests, experiments, beta versions, and that's really the wrong attitude. The world needs to run, I think, aggressively into transformation instead of tiptoeing up to it. So it illustrates, I guess, where design stops and the need for like large scale policy change and, you know, setting our collective ambitions much higher than they are.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly couldn't agree more. This building is a result of philanthropy, which is fabulous, but in order to really go to scale, how do we really get cities, much more of our built environment, to take on the kinds of challenges? And it is interesting just to watch the ripple effects already from this building. There were so many consultant firms and all involved and industries involved, and locally, you already do see them sort of realizing like, okay, now we know about the red list, detoxified materials, we're only using that now. And that kind of thing is clearly, we're seeing it happen. But you've worked for corporate headquarters, and some of them with some pretty deep pockets, Google and LinkedIn, as well as for public clients. I don't know if the India Basin project was a public client in San Francisco, but downtown Sunnyvale, a corridor retrofit in Pittsburgh. Who do you see taking the lead?
You know, since the recession, I have just personally observed a loss in capacity of public institutions and an increase in capacity of private ones. I think there's a lot of forces that created that. But capitalism is the biggest one. And what I see creating demand for the building we're sitting in right now, or campuses of a new breed, or even infrastructure with greater ambitions, is really the demand for it by the clients, by the users, by the markets. I think that's what's driving change more now than a policy directive at a kind of national level, which if you zoom out and look at other countries do this in, you know, are well on their way to this kind of full-scale market transformation, where we're still looking at it as though it's suspect and it's anti-growth. And I think that's the issue. I mean, as much as I want to talk about design, I can't help but sort of criticize the mechanisms for making policy and really large scale change. The ironic thing is that the market is out there, the interest is out there, the want and need is out there, and it's downward pressure that keeps it suppressed.
I mean, is it more expensive?
I think it is, but I think that is a niche or a markup that can be captured right now. It shouldn't be. It should be standard.
Yeah.
Like why? Yeah, it should be standard. There's lots of there's lots of examples of why, like, why should a low volume flush toilet be more expensive than a regular one? Why should toxic materials be less expensive than non-toxic materials? That's ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, so let's talk a little about design and the role that design can play to certainly build more public support, build more kind of demand and desire for better. Certainly better looking places, and yes, by the way, they're also better, healthier and better performing. Is design how you really help the greater public recognize the ecological value of the native grasses, the bioswales, and not just seeing those as somehow, oh my gosh, we're going back to unmowed lawns and ditches. And yeah. There's a lot of design that goes into making it, I think, very clear that these are not just ditches. These are not just, the native grasses are planted in very orderly grids. And yeah. I don't know, do you see that as part of a kind of educating the public? Or
I do. I think most people don't care about the performance of things. They don't care about the stuff that architects and landscape architects talk about. They care about the experience, their daily lives, their enjoyment, their pleasure. And they passively, you know, want the world to be better and smarter, but they mostly care about sort of the world in front of them. So I think design's greatest effects are that it's immersive, it's immediately convincing. Nobody's going to walk into this building and be like, I like the old ones better, right? And so it has the ability to kind of transform minds immediately. I think that's the most powerful thing. The other thing I would say about just design in some of our sort of the largest challenges that, you know, we're facing today, the ones that are affecting people in dramatic ways, disasters, sea level rise, entire cities being dramatically impacted overnight. Design offers a way to look at those forces, the things stressing large populations in cities, and to put that into ambitious and life-enriching terms while addressing these kind of profound underlying problems. And I think that that's where change in public support will come.
So give us an example from your work.
I'll use sea level rise because I think everybody grasps the implications of that. Fear doesn't work. What does work are, you know, the shifts out of their everyday life. Addressing sea level rise can transform waterfronts, how it can lift people up out of inequity, how it can make their daily lives better. And I think the best examples of that are when people we address issues that, you know, the mundane everyday issues. So like our work with sea level rises in the Bay Area has looked at opportunities you can create out of parking, what you can do with bike lanes, how, let's say, like a very low tech parks could become very highly enabled centers for community resilience, how food security could be addressed. And when you put it, I think, in everyday terms versus slow motion disaster terms, you're much more persuasive to influence change.
I love those examples. My own work, it looks a lot at how the many things we can be doing with a lot of our excess parking lots in particular. Tell us, how are you reusing parking lots and sea level rise for all these other things?
Well, personally, like, I'm just observing how dominant cars are in suppressing all other life forms. And I guess being from California, it's just rich with examples. Coming to Atlanta, I think it is rich with examples. And so on a project basis, it's very tactical. It's, you know, a half acre and an acre at a time. We have a project for LinkedIn's headquarters that removes acres of parking and converts it to places for people in a really large scale stormwater system. We have examples in Sunnyvale, California, which is the city bookended by Google at one end and Apple at the other. We're making a walkable downtown. It's just a radical concept. And we're remaking a Silicon Valley downtown. And so I think it means something different on every project, but I would say that they're tactical in that you're looking at every situation and kind of assessing many complexities to be the thrust of invention.
I love seeing those kinds of projects. And I want to also, I guess, kind of return to the question of, I agree with you, you know, I think there are amazing examples of the private sector leading, but I certainly noticed in my own work, the sea change, almost literally, in how certainly architects, urban designers have been trained to think about water, mm-hmm. stormwater in particular, since the EPA began about a decade ago, really telling everybody, okay, you know, the regulations now emphasize this goal of trying, as you're building, you have to try to restore the hydrological pre-development function, mm-hmm. you know, so however much water that site before it was developed was able to capture, infiltrate, you've got to do that now yeah. on site. And it seems to me that it's really, especially in landscape architecture, it's just generated a wealth of creative ideas and ways to rethink what green infrastructure is. We're kind of still inventing
yeah.
more and more new ways. Are there examples of other kinds of regulations we probably should do the same thing?
That will spark the imagination of designers, and all the obvious ones, energy, waste, water, I would still consider them to be sort of in a pilot phase. And my question is, will we ever see the important things, the numbers move by this sort of piecemeal site-by-site approach? I think the large-scale complex projects are the ones that you have to do, not because they're easy, but because they're hard, right? And that's the biggest challenge for cities. I see the private sector driving demand, but it's still only on this kind of site-by-site basis. And I think that's frustrating as a designer. I think one of the things that sea level rise and climate change present is just the window for larger scale, more synthetic thinking. There's no recognition of property lines and jurisdictional boundaries. And so those are coming our way. And sort of being able to think transformatively about remaking cities out of kind of necessity versus out of some policy mandate. Right, many of these consent decrees that cities are under are, you know, they're kind of ignored or they can be skirted. But these sort of larger scale forces of kind of fires and floods are here now.
Yeah, I mean, I think the visibility of the fires and floods is certainly, we're getting more of the population to at least believe that climate change is not a hoax. We, you know,
right.
and be willing to address it. I think what's also, though, fascinating are the opportunities to sometimes address the less immediately visual. So sea level rise, we can all look at the drawings and, okay, it's going to come up to here. If you're in Miami, you can see a blue sky flooding, kind of right. just high tides coming up the drains. But in general, it's still sort of out there. We see hurricanes and tornado damage, the fires, that's really visible. Inequity. How designers are beginning to really take on those challenges within cities. I was intrigued with the decision in the India Basin project in San Francisco about how to break the block grid, mm-hmm. dealing with some of those less visible. They're not so immediately visible, but they have real visible ramifications.
Yeah. Landscape architects are, I think, strapped by a lack of creativity in a lot of cases, that they're thought to be the ones that use five or six materials, dirt and rocks and trees, to solve all manner of problems. And the world's more complicated than that. The problems are bigger than that. I think that we need to be more synthetic in our thinking, both in terms of the technology and the materials that we engage, but also, you know, our formative influence on architecture, on urban design. And just decorating is a real failure of obligation. We approach everything we do with a kind of ambition, even the smallest projects, just to maybe to demonstrate the capacity of invention, but also just imagination and creativity. Some places have no ecological function, but they have an obligation to, say, like, enrich culture and stimulate the public realm. So any project we engage in is really looking at that in the most imaginative way.
I mean, I think the engineers, the architects, the planners, the urban designers, we're all looking to the landscape architects saying, you guys know plants. You're actually taught something about the living systems in a way that none of the rest of us are. And we look to you guys to lead us in understanding how the ecology really performs and how our interventions can be for good and not for bad and and all of that.
Yeah, of course, we have to know and own the medium, but I don't think stop there. I think, you know, expanding the medium, bringing greater intelligence to it, bringing its incorporation with technology and evolving it is new territory. And that's part of the ambition of Bionic, was to push at those edges and test those possibilities through our projects. We started out in this kind of really on paper projects and sort of thinking about all of those possibilities in a kind of theoretical way. And over the past decade, you know, have moved that into just our approach to projects, to everything we do.
So how much did your education in landscape architecture prepare you to deal with all the levels of complexity?
Got me halfway there.
That's probably not bad.
Yeah, I have an undergraduate in landscape architecture and a graduate degree in landscape architecture. And my undergrad was a Bachelor of Science. So all the fundamentals, the basis of being a generalist. And graduate school, I went to the GSD, and I think the best thing about graduate school for me and for that program was that there wasn't a lot of requirements. It was just 2 years to work on kind of imagination and creativity.
I want to see more landscape architects come and study urban design, especially at Georgia Tech. Is there anything you would recommend to current students, or how else might you change the curriculum if you could?
Oh, well, I'm totally envious of students. I would just generally say that I love that time, and the time to your student is the time to really indulge in your own ideas and the possibility of them. You never get that kind of time and space to define yourself intellectually. And I think the one thing I would say in my observation of design students today is there's just not enough design. There's a lot of let's say analyzing the world and standing in the face of issues, but really developing your design ability while you're in school is really designing something, giving shape and form to your work and your ideas, and testing them against the world you see and the problems presented in the studio, is the best thing that you can do.
I think part of what cities need are more professionals who truly understand and value the collaboration with the other disciplines and the interactions between them. And you know, too much of our landscape has been designed by everybody operating in silos and just optimizing whatever their one piece of the turf is. So also, yeah, I completely agree. You know, landscape architects have such an important role to play, but it is a role to play with others.
Yeah, I think a professional skill, I'm not sure if you can teach it, is how you actually influence projects, where the monetary forces of a project are so influential. What are ideas that are strong enough to survive the rigor of architecture and everything that's codified, be it right or wrong? You know, that takes powerful imagination. It takes a certain force of personality. But I think, you know, good ideas survive. So.
Well, and that is where, I mean, in an ideal world, we want the ecological imagination to be triggered and really design has a very important role to represent ideas about nature and technology and the world we live in as we design them. But at the same, that's always the piece that's most subject to value engineering, and that's where then some of the performative aspects are easier to justify.
I think. You can shelter behind some performative aspect or behind a number. I think it is certainly more challenging to break the common perception of landscape architects of just doing the plants, which is fine. But I prefer something that's an approach to projects which is much more creative and sort of more boldly synthetic. We have one project where there's something like $10 million worth of structural upgrades to hold air handling units. But just by sitting in meetings with engineers and architects, we made our way into that conversation, found out that there's just a really healthy stream of condensate, and we captured that and influenced budgets and decision making to make that part of the water security and supply for a whole kind of 5-acre site. So the idea that air conditioners are supporting a wetland and habitats for pollinators and avian species, that's the territory of invention that I think is is powerful. It's performative, but it also just generates a beautiful immersive environment that anybody can appreciate.
Well, the last question is philosophical, so it might, I don't know if you can get it down to three sentences or not. What does ecology mean today if, as Bionic appears to be arguing, we now live in an age where the digital and the natural are inseparably interdependent?
I think that's what it means. I really do. Not to chicken out, but I really do think they're interrelated. But it's ecology is isn't the etymology oikos? It's the relationship of systems to one another. As a landscape architect, I think it's the landscape architect's domain to make it work. They might coexist, but really making them work together takes that expertise and the leadership and the kind of vision that motivates all of the resources needed to kind of bring ideas into reality.
So ecology now, we just can't think of it separate from infrastructure.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I think the original word is the relationship of systems. I think conventionally it's of natural systems, and it's. I think it's needs to expand to mean unnatural and natural.
So as we redesign cities, for ecology, and for with a sort of ecological imagination. We inherently are really also have to recognize how to kind of make use of technology as, whether it's prosthetic devices, as mappings,
and I would argue for landscape architects taking a larger role, being more imaginative, and starting to kind of lead the disciplines we've always followed.
Marcel Wilson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Please join me.
To close on, you've been listening to Ellen Dunham Jones, host of Redesigning Cities, speaking with Marcel Wilson, founder of Bionic, landscape architecture firm in San Francisco.
Thanks. I really appreciate the invitation to come and talk to you.
Thank you.